Hi, I'm Karen Given, executive producer of Only a Game. Last week, I told you about NPR's year-end digital fundraising campaign and the trophy, yes, a real physical trophy, we can win if Only a Game listeners donate enough money. But this week, I want to talk about something even more important than a trophy, and that's supporting the great stories and analysis you hear on Only a Game. After our appeal last week, listener Harrison Markey tweeted, "Did it for Sherman." Thanks, Harrison. I think Sherman the Donkey is pretty special, too. So this is a good time to ask, what Only a Game story touched you over the past year? Maybe it was Charles Barkley's unlikely friendship with a cat litter scientist, or Bob Cousy's attempt to reach out to NBA great Bill Russell, or maybe that story about the man who's bringing pickleball to prisons. Whatever it was that touched you, we couldn't have done it without your support. So we're asking right now for you to pause this podcast and go to donate.npr.org/game to make a donation to your local station. That's donate.npr.org/game to find your local station and get started. And thanks. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. For his latest book, John U. Bacon spent the 2018 college football season with Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines. The book came out in September, and since then, whenever John stands in front of a crowd to promote the book, he always tells the same story. It was August of 2018, and John had just started his season with Michigan. John's wife, Christy, took their then 3.5-year-old son, Teddy, to fan night.
And he's running around on the field and having a great time. But that begged the question, and that is, if Teddy wanted to, would we let him play football? At that time, we really did not have an answer. We were not sure for all the reasons that other parents are also not sure.
So then something about this next story made you feel like you had an answer?
Talking to the Newsoms in particular changed our minds.
But this is a little bit of a tragic story.
It is kind of a tragic story, but I figured that Grant Newsom and his parents would be the acid test. I wanted to ask them, is it worth it?
And he did. Here's John.
Leon Newsom had been an all-Ivy League football player at Princeton, but Leon and his wife Kim did not want their oldest son, Grant, to play football. But when Grant went away to Lawrenceville Academy in New Jersey, he could not resist joining the freshman football team. By his sophomore year, Grant started on the varsity. He was so good that his coach had a warning for Leon and Kim.
He sat us down and he said to us, if Grant wants to do this, he's going to play college football. And I was floored because that was not a conversation I expected to be having when he started playing freshman football in ninth grade.
Junior year, Grant received offers from 34 schools, including every Ivy League team and most of the nation's top 20 programs. The recruiting experience was a whirlwind for Grant and for his parents. In the spring of his junior year, the Newsoms drove to Penn State for a recruiting visit and stopped for gas.
So we pull into the Sheets about 90 miles away from Happy Valley, and I'm walking into the bathroom, and my dad's behind me, and there's a man who's coming out. And he looks at me and goes, Grant Newsom? I said, yes. And he said, you know, I'm a huge fan. You know, I really hope you come to Penn State. You know, we'd love to have you. And then I kid you not, before we left the Sheets, there was another fan came up and said, Grant Newsom, blah, blah, blah. We really need you in the offensive line.
It was weird that he couldn't go to the bathroom, but also just tells you how fanatical the fan base is at some of these schools.
When Grant and his parents visited Penn State again, Grant went away thoroughly impressed by the coaching staff and the football program.
And I left that Penn State visit thinking I was going to be a Nittany Lion.
We were driving home and I thought, well, it's game over.
But Grant had one more visit planned, the University of Michigan. Unlike Penn State, Michigan was headed for a rare losing season. But the Newsoms still liked everything else about the town, the campus, and the academics. After 2 weeks of deliberating,
I still couldn't decide, and I remember it vividly. I'm sitting in our living room, and my mom says, no, hey, what are you thinking? And I said, no, I have no idea, Mom. I'm torn between these two schools. You know, it'd be a flip of a coin at this point.
And I said, well, take football out of it. If football goes away, because nothing in this life is guaranteed, where do you want to be?
I said, well, it's no question. It's Michigan. And she said, there's your answer. And that's why I ended up at the University of Michigan.
Shortly after Grant made his decision, Michigan fired the entire coaching staff and hired Jim Harbaugh, fresh from the NFL's San Francisco 49ers. A few days later, Harbaugh called Grant.
He introduces himself and he says, do you have any questions for me? And I said, I guess my only question is, you know, do you guys still want me? And he said, you know, if you're loyal to me, if you're loyal to Michigan, we're loyal to you. And that was all I needed to hear.
Grant assumed he would not play until his sophomore season to save a year of eligibility. But during a team meeting before Michigan's eighth game, Coach Harbaugh pointed right to him.
You know, kind of just like in a passing comment in a meeting says, Grant, you know, be ready. You're playing this week. And I just kind of looked around and was aghast. And pointed at myself saying, me? Grant Newsom, me?
Grant played well. So well that just 1 year later, he was not only starting at left tackle, the blind side, he was already being pegged as a future NFL star.
Another top 10 showdown for you. Steve Levy, Brian.
In the fifth game of the 2016 season, the fourth-ranked Wolverines took on the eighth-ranked Wisconsin Badgers and a future All-American linebacker named T.J. Watt.
So I knew I had my work cut out for me, but we're playing well. I believe it was 7-0 at that point. Been holding my own, blocking him pretty well. So I was feeling good. I was feeling like we had the game where we wanted it.
And then the coaches called a play called 99 Truck, in which the quarterback pitches the ball to the running back. He runs behind Grant, who clears the way by diving at the defender's legs, a maneuver called cutting, as in cutting him down. But right before the snap, Grant had a premonition.
I get this voice inside my head, and I kid you not, it's never happened to me ever again. It's my voice, and it says, if you don't cut him on this play, he's going to cut you. So the ball snapped, and you know, something about it just didn't feel right.
Hand off to Smith off the Kitchabegger Park.
And I remember thinking, you know, as I'm running towards this defender, there's not enough room for me to cut. If I cut, I'm just going to clog the hole, and it's going to be a 3-yard gain. So there's going to be nowhere for the running back to go. You know, and this is obviously happening in split seconds. So I make the decision. I said, I'm going to stay up.
You're going to take one for the team, essentially.
Essentially, I'm going to stay up and try to block him and minimize the amount of bodies on the ground that are going to be occupying this hole the running back needs to run through. And the last thing I remember was making that decision to stay up. And I see him start to cut, and that's the last thing I remember before I'm on the ground.
That was probably for the best. The defender had gone headfirst straight into Grant's right knee with a force so great it shoved Grant's knee 60 degrees in the wrong direction. Grant crumbled to the ground, landing on his stomach.
Unfortunately, it looks like their left tackle, Grant Newsom, still on the ground.
And I remember trying to crawl, and then one of my teammates came and said, Grant, you got to get up. I remember saying, I'm trying. And it didn't feel like my body wouldn't let me get up. The training staff and our team doctors and Coach Harbaugh come out, and they say, all right, can you turn over for us? And I turn over, and I feel my knee pop.
So you can hear it.
You can hear it. So I think I just tore my ACL turning over.
And you say this.
I say, I just tore my effing ACL turning over. So with heavy assistance, I walk off the field, and right before the tunnel, this fact hits me that my mom is in attendance, and I know she's probably sobbing at this point already. So I turn, and I try to give a thumbs up, you know, towards the section I know they're sitting in, to say, hey, look, I'm fine. You know, even if it's a torn ACL, I'm fine. You know, we'll be able to get through this.
Waved off the stretcher, and the ambulance wants to walk off on his own power. You see the thumbs up, and this is...
Grant and the medical staff went to the team's emergency room under the stands, and were soon joined by Leon, Kim, and Grant's two younger brothers.
And it didn't seem like he was in a ton of pain. He was sitting up, asking if he could go back out and watch the rest of the game from the sidelines. And they said, well, we're going to hold on for a little bit. And
they initially thought it may just be a sprained MCL. So at this point, I'm thinking, whoa, I just went from thinking I tore my ACL to now it's a sprain. I was doing the math at this point. I'm thinking, I'll be back for Michigan State. I'll be back for Ohio State, certainly. So at this point, I'm pretty overjoyed.
But at the end of the exam, the doctors asked Grant if he had any tingling or numbness in his toes.
I said, well, yeah, I have a lot of numbness in my toes, but I'm sure that's probably normal.
It was not normal. The tingling indicated the main artery which delivers blood to his leg had been damaged.
And they both look at each other and say, yeah, we're going to take you to the hospital for a few tests.
And then very quickly, we were getting in an ambulance and going to the hospital.
Grant underwent x-rays, CT scans, and an MRI, trying to find the vascular injury.
After each test, no one will tell me the results. You kind of get this sinking feeling like something isn't right here. And keep in mind, my family and I are watching the Wisconsin-Michigan game from the room. On TV, in the emergency department. So we're watching this, we're following, we're cheering. The nurses are trying to shush us because we're cheering too loud.
Michigan knew there'd be a game they wouldn't score 45 points in. But this was it. They scored 14. And that's enough to beat Wisconsin.
And not 5 minutes after the game ends, Dr. Matt Corriere, who ended up being my vascular surgeon, comes into the room, and he puts what's called a Doppler, which is a machine that kind of amplifies the sound of your blood pumping. He puts that on my toes, listens for maybe 10 seconds at most, and says, "All right, Grant, we're going to take you into emergency surgery. The lower part of your leg is getting 50% of the blood it needs to survive." I just look at him and was like, "What?" I had no idea we were talking about something this serious. And I couldn't even imagine it, even being at the hospital. And so I kind of look at him and look at my family, and the only words I can think to formulate are, "Am I going to have a leg when this is done?" And the last thing I remember is saying, "We're going to try our best."
The surgery was supposed to last 4 hours. Kim, Leon, and Grant's brothers waited and waited and waited.
It was 7 hours. It felt like an eternity.
Dr. Corriere finally emerged and told the family
they were able to save his leg, and they thought the surgery was successful.
Doctors told the Newsoms if they had operated just 15 minutes later, Grant might have lost his leg. His mom was right. Football could be taken away in an instant. In the days that followed, doctors removed a large chunk of Grant's lower right calf muscle, which had already turned black from lack of blood flow, and bolted a metal rod to his thigh and shin bones to immobilize his knee. Grant recovered in the hospital for more than a month.
The highlight of my day was moving the 2 feet to the chair that was in the hospital room.
Grant stayed in school and started rehab.
My right thigh was the size of my left calf. I took my second first steps of my life 2 months after the injury, and that those first steps were kind of like the Wright brothers of Kitty Hawk. It was a very short flight.
Thanks to a lot of hard work and a lot of help, with the coaches and trainers visiting every night for weeks, after 6 months, Grant could jog again. 6 months after that, he could run full speed. He was determined to return to the team. The idea secretly terrified his parents, but they supported him. Almost 2 years after the injury, in August of 2018, Grant was practicing with the team again.
I was able to do all of the team conditioning, essentially, and I feel good. I essentially do everything we could do, just without pads on and without contact.
But at practice a few days later,
I was just watching an offensive lineman and a defensive lineman go head-to-head on a blocking drill, and it just hit me like, you don't have this anymore. It was just this epiphany moment of, is what I'm trying to do worth it?
After practice ended, Grant paced the length of the grass field.
Finally woke up the courage to call my dad and say, "Hey, I think I'm going to hang it up. I think it's time."
Leon told Grant that if he was sure about his decision, he would support it.
So I hang up with him, probably pace another 2 miles in that field, back and forth, and then finally call my mom. My mom's a crier. So I call her and, tell her, and I just hear 30 seconds of silence on the phone.
I just wanted my son to be okay. And I was worried about who his people were going to be now if he didn't have his team.
But Grant still had his people. He still had his team. Grant is now helping the tight ends, analyzing film, and sending in plays while getting his master's degree from Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy.
Coach Harbaugh and the rest of the Michigan family embraced him and continued to embrace him in a way that I will be forever grateful for.
Big question. Was it all worth it?
That is the million-dollar question, as they say. And my answer is yes. Emphatically yes. Everyone likes the joke that Mission got there. They got their money's worth with me. But I think I got all that and more from Michigan, and I'm really just extremely grateful.
In some ways, I think everything happens for a reason, and I think this was to help him realize that he has what it takes to get through the tough times.
I think it's made Grant stronger. It's made us stronger as parents, and so I wouldn't change that for anything.
In my book, Leon said this: "I believe to the bottom of my heart that Grant will leave Michigan as well prepared to face the world as any young man could be."
That's John U. Bacon. His new book is titled Overtime, Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines at the Crossroads of College Football. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This week on Ask Me Another, we challenge singer Paula Cole to a game about birds, but not before she quizzes us. Morning Dove.
Yes.
Yeah. This and more on NPR's Ask Me Another. Listen now.
I'm Karen Gibbon, and it's time for three stories you should know.
I think there's just some big change coming, and it's long overdue, and I'm excited.
That's former NHL player Akeem Alou speaking on Tuesday. Alou has accused his former coach, Bill Peters, of making racist comments. Other players have come forward alleging physical abuse by Peters and other NHL coaches. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed via Skype and by New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello, Karen. Hi, Will.
An honor, as always. Thank you.
Shireen, fill us in.
Wow, it's been busy in Canada. You know, this all on the tails of Don Cherry, the Hockey Night in Canada host that was fired by Sportsnet for sharing his xenophobic comments and then walking back and not apologizing for them. So Canada and Canadian hockey and hockey culture generally has begun unintentionally and in a very ill-prepared manner, begun a conversation about racism in hockey. And then that has sort of also gone in a way where hockey players have come out to talk about abusive coaches. Alou said what happened was 10 years ago when he played for the Rockport Ice Hogs. And Rob Brind'Amour, who is the now coach of the Carolina Hurricanes, actually corroborated Alou's account. And so that's where we are right now, is me sort of trying to sort of parse out what should be addressed. And honestly, as one of the few people of color who's a sports writer in my country, sort of saying this is who you should be paying attention to and this is who you should be unlearning from.
So, Shireen, coaches got pulled into this conversation when the Maple Leafs fired Mike Babcock. He was let go for not winning games. So how did that turn into this broader conversation?
Well, what happened was Mitch Marner, a Toronto Maple Leaf player, came forward and disclosed that he was punched and kicked. And then people sort of paused and made the usual pronouncements. Oh, he's just very passionate as a coach. I mean, we hear about Bobby Knight being legendary and being aggressive as a coach, but this was a different level. And then different players started coming forward and it became a thing. Social media really, really became a thing in terms of a vehicle for people to disclose this.
Will, what do you make of all this?
You know, I always find it telling how much influence players themselves have in this. And to me, that's encouraging because the thing about players is that they're young. And really, like, the people that defend this kind of activity are always these old guard people. And they'll always claim, well, that's the way it's always been. And that's the way it should be. This reminds me a little bit of when the Richie Incognito thing happened in football a few years ago, where there was this idea, like, you can't police locker rooms. The locker room is not a normal place of business. It's different. It's men. It's so and whatnot. Except then a bunch of players came out and said, no, this is not what it's supposed to be like, and we don't want our workplace to be like this. It shows that older guard that claims these are the way that things are supposed to be were obsolete years ago. You mentioned Bob Knight. There aren't a lot of Bob Knight defenders anymore. These conversations tend to have a wider effect and a quicker effect in large part because the players themselves are standing up for what they believe.
Yeah, I read a comment this week from Georges Laroque. He played 12 seasons in the NHL, and he compared what's happening to the Me Too movement. And while the type and severity of the abuse is certainly different, I don't think he's entirely wrong making that comparison. You have a situation where the balance of power is extremely unbalanced, and abuse of that power has apparently been relatively widespread and well known. Nobody was much trying to hide it, it seems like. And once a couple of people found the courage to come forward and say, this is not right, other people came forward as well, and now we're really getting a bigger picture. But it seems clear to me, and I could be wrong, but it seems clear that when these players got kicked or verbally abused or their coach made a racist comment, it probably wasn't the first time that happened to them in the game, because if it was, I don't think everyone would have ignored it so easily and for so long. The New York Times is calling it a cultural upheaval. So, Shireen, I'm wondering how long before it trickles down to the lower levels of the game?
Well, I like the term cultural upheaval far more than I like the comparison, although I'm a huge fan of LARAC, the comparison with the Me Too. I don't like it at all. I think we shouldn't have to do the suppression Olympics within abuse in order to do this. And even the conflation of the racist abuse versus physical and verbal and psychological, which is all there. Those that have to deal with racialized abuse is far different and carries different types of trauma than psychological and physical would, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in terms of when it will trickle down, the whole system needs to change here. Kwame Mason is the director of a really fantastic film called Soul on Ice, which speaks about Black players in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the East Coast of Canada. And he said, hockey is innately diverse. It stems across many communities, Indigenous, Black communities. The Punjabi community has their own TV show, Hockey Night in Punjabi, which is wildly popular. So hockey has touched across those lines, but it's not inclusive. And we need to start having very candid conversations. And for me, who leads those conversations is imperative. I don't like the word reckoning, because reckoning to me infers accountability. And I haven't seen that from the gatekeepers in hockey.
All right, so this week, my tender heart was broken when I learned that the Tampa Bay Rays have been forced to abandon their plans to split time between St. Petersburg and Montreal, at least until 2028. Okay, look, I know that for many reasons, this was a terrible idea. It's logistically ridiculous. It would be a nightmare for players and their families. And in the end, it might have just been an excuse for the Rays to shake down two cities in two separate countries for two new ballparks. On the other hand, neither St. Petersburg nor Montreal seem to be able to support a full-time team, and both cities seem to want one, and I personally was looking forward to visiting Montreal in the summertime to watch some baseball. Shireen, are you also sad?
I'm happy because Expo gear was really cool and is like super retro. So yeah. I will acquire a hat at some point. I agree with you. I don't even know how this is possible. But you know what this does is make me a little bit frustrated, because the lengths that people will go to and can go to for sport is phenomenal. And then part of me is like, why don't people just invest in women's sports this way? So I kind of have a different lens.
Will, what do you make of this?
A large part of this came down to the fact that cities will no longer pay for this stuff anymore. Yeah. There was a time where maybe 15 years ago, this ploy might have worked. The idea like, oh, we're going to revitalize downtown. All the money's going to stay in the community. Don't worry. Sure, there's a tax break and a bond break and you're paying for 3/4 of the stadium. But trust us, we owners will give it back to you, citizens. And so for crying out loud, the new Yankee Stadium and Citi Field were built in large part by Giuliani. Sneaking that stuff out the door on his way out. To me, this has been a very welcome development over the last 5-10 years. City councils don't buy this anymore. States don't buy this anymore. There's occasionally, it's sadness because like, oh, we might lose our team or we have to figure this stuff out. But in the long run, it's good because they're not just giving over the farm to these owners anymore.
Yeah, the one thing St. Petersburg really did right is someone there knew how to draw up an ironclad use agreement. It's not even a lease. And the Rays can't break it. Like, they just can't get out of it. And part of me wants the Rays to continue playing at the Tropicana, which is a terrible place to watch baseball. And continue to have some of the lowest attendance numbers in baseball and continue to lose money, because maybe that will convince billionaire owners that even if they can find a city that will give them a free stadium, they'd be better off building their own. This is my hope. All right, well, take it away.
I am a fan of the University of Illinois football team who, what's the right word to put it? They're bad. They've been terrible forever. Watching this team has been horrible. They've been a miserable team. But this year behind Lovie Smith, who is a coach of Illinois football, Illinois is 6-6. They're still not very good. But they're going to play in one of these silly little lower tier bowls. These bowls do not matter. There's literally a bowl called the Cheez-It Bowl. is in the grand tradition of really silly bowls that are not for a championship and have very bizarre sponsors, from the Poland Weed Eater Bowl to the MicronPC.com Bowl. Anyway, the point is, all of these tiny little bowls, they're ridiculous. They probably don't need to exist, but they are good for fans of teams and players of teams like this. This year, it's very likely that Illinois is going to go to Detroit the day after Christmas. The Quick Lane Bowl, I don't know what Quick Lane is. I have no idea. But that's the bowl they might be playing at. And it makes me happy to have all these little silly bowls as a place to basically get us through that week between Christmas and New Year's and give us something to do rather than talk to our families.
Shireen, what do you think?
I really, really appreciate these smaller things, because it's almost like reclaiming a bit of the sport in a way. Mm. It's not only the Super Bowl. It's not only the Rose Bowl. There can be other things and everyone can take part in that. And I like that. It's almost like grassroots in a way, even though we know that teams are huge and the schools are big. But I really appreciate the frivolity almost of it, because sometimes sports needs that.
All right. So you all have convinced me that meaningless bowl games are good. But can we all agree on one thing? And that is, if a player for one of these teams that's not that great happens to be declaring for the NFL draft and he wants to skip that meaningless bowl game, we're all going to be okay with it, right? Because all the drama over, like, he should be playing for the love of his team, or he should be playing for the love of the game, when the CEO of the Outback Bowl made $1 million in change last year, really just harshes on my enjoyment of this corporate spectacle that bowl games have become.
You know, I have to say, though, that makes me feel like you are disrespecting the San Diego County Credit Union Bowl. And I have to tell you, if you're not going to support, it's funny, as a fan of college football and I watch the San Diego County Credit Union Bowl, I'm not even sure what they're selling me in that ad. Can I join them? I don't live in San Diego. Can I give the credit union? I'm not employed by anyone in San Diego. Why are they sponsoring this ball? But nevertheless, yes, I don't understand why a lot of these college players play in the championship game if they've got million dollar deals to go in the NFL. But that is probably a whole other discussion for a whole other time.
Probably.
Imagine being at home and being like, well, you know, I'm generally happy with my bank, but...
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed and New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you as always.
Last June, Laura Ehrenschild found herself somewhere she never expected to be, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, watching her father compete at the national level in a sport he started taking seriously in his 70s. Here's Laura.
This ping pong table has become the site of a showdown. It's the OK Corral of table tennis. But instead of multiple gunslingers on either side, there are only two old men holding paddles. And one is my father. My dad, Jay Ehrenschild, is crouched like a shortstop, swinging his arms to keep his muscles loose, stopping once to brush his white hair out of his eyes. His opponent, a 74-year-old Californian named David, looks tough, if slightly stoop-shouldered. Lean frame, tan skin, what appears to be a tailored polo shirt. The man's eyes are locked on my dad. His mouth is set in a fierce line. They volley. David wins the first point. From the sidelines, Dad's youngest brother, my 65-year-old Uncle Ricky, claps his hands. Come on, Jay, don't let up, Uncle Ricky says. You get an offensive shot, you take it. Come on, Jay, come on, come on, adds their friend Carrie. Come on, man, you got this. We're in Albuquerque, New Mexico for the 2019 National Senior Games, a once-every-2-years Olympic-style event that invites athletes ages 50 to over 100 to flex their athletic prowess in everything from archery to pickleball. The whole thing feels surreal. Dad is competing on a national level in a sport he only started taking seriously a couple years ago in his 70s. David is kicking my dad's butt, blasting every shot off corners and sending my dad lunging in wild directions. Dad is sweating, breathing hard. But he's also grinning and laughing and making jokes. He's flashing smiles at my mom, basically flirting. And I think, when I am 73, please let me have this kind of life. My dad's ping pong group is something special. A diverse group of mostly older men at a time when diversity and older men are not phrases I often connect. The group started 5 or 6 years ago when one of my dad's friends, Dia Aldori, a physician who fled Iraq during Saddam Hussein's reign, realized he needed something to keep his body moving as he got older. After some research, Dia, everyone calls him Doc, settled on ping pong. It didn't take long for the group to start playing in small competitions. By the summer of 2018, Dad had qualified for the National Senior Games, and after that, he and his friends started training in earnest. They traveled to other ping pong clubs, testing themselves against different players. Doc hired a coach, a kid in his 20s who was trying to make the actual U.S. table tennis team. My dad started watching what he ate. Fewer late-night potato chips, more vegetables. Last spring, Dad's training was on pace, and his game was getting stronger. He and my mom booked a bed and breakfast in Old Town Albuquerque for a week around the senior games, and she started making plans to visit Santa Fe and the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum to sample New Mexico's famous chili rellenos. And then, my dad cut off his finger. It was April 17th, 9 weeks before the National Senior Games, when my mom's number flashed on my phone. It was just before lunchtime on a workday, a strange time for her to call.
"I don't want you to worry,"
my mom started. And if the words had had physical form, they would have quivered.
"But we are in the emergency room."
Dad had been in the middle of a woodworking project, sawing a chunk of wood into smaller, thinner pieces, when the blade sucked in the shim he'd been using as a guide, dragging Dad's finger along with it. The blade sliced his index finger neatly at the first knuckle. He was lucky in a few regards. One, the doctors thought that his finger could be reattached, so he might not lose it entirely. Two, he hadn't lost much blood. And three, the finger happened to be on his left hand. His right hand, his paddle hand, was unharmed. Doc was the first person to show up at my parents' house after the table saw accident. Dad was under strict, no ping pong, at least for now, orders from his doctor. Doc wanted to make sure my dad wasn't lonely. A couple days later, Rob, my dad's doubles partner, called to see if Dad wanted to go to lunch. Uncle Ricky came over and cut the grass. When Dad went back to practice, of course he went back to practice, the doctor said he needed to keep his injured finger safe. That meant no lunging in ways that might cause him to fall, no swinging his arm as he served and accidentally knocking it into a table or wall. Dad's friends policed this the same way they played ping pong. Mercilessly. At the National Senior Games in June, the air inside the Albuquerque Convention Center is filled with the rhythmic sounds of ping pong balls bouncing off tables and shoes squeaking on a linoleum floor. Dad's finger is mostly healed, but not quite. Per his doctor's orders, it is still set in a splint and wrapped tightly in an elastic bandage. He can't move it at all. On the court, things are not going well. When David wins game 3, a shutout match, my dad places the ball on the table, shakes David's hand, and walks over to the sidelines where his friends and my mom are waiting. "Don't give up, Jay," Carrie says. Dad takes a swig of water, pulls a towel across his neck, and heads back out to the court to face the next competitor. If he loses again, he's out. Dad's second match is against a tall, lanky, friendly guy, a semi-retired pastor at a Lutheran church in Minnesota. The first game starts out okay. Dad scores a couple, the pastor scores a couple, and then the pastor pulls ahead, up by 2, up by 5. Maybe a higher power was pulling for the pastor. Maybe Dad was just too nervous. Or maybe the pastor was just better at ping pong, but it's a deflating start for my dad. Carrie leans over to me. "He's got to get some confidence going forward, just a little spark," he says in a low voice. Game 2 has already started, and almost immediately my dad picks up a great point and goes on a roll. Game 2, Dad. The match is tied. "The pendulum just swung," Uncle Ricky tells my dad. "Now you got the momentum." Dad wins game 3 and goes up 2-1. One more will give him his first win in a national tournament match. Dad scores again and again, and soon it's 7-4 Dad, and now Carrie and my uncle are on their feet. But then the pastor starts scoring. 7-5, 7-6, 7-7. Tie game. "Jay, I want you to get an attitude, man," Carrie shouts, and maybe that clicks because Dad starts scoring again. Before long, it's 10-8, and then Dad is sending the ball over the net, and the passer can't get there in time. 11-8, game and match. Dad's first national win. From my dad and his ping pong friends, I've learned. We can approach life like it's something to be survived and endured, something to be fought, something to be beaten. We can give up when something tough happens, sink back into our easy chairs, and never get up again. Or we can wrap life in our best embrace and allow ourselves new experiences with new people in new places. We can challenge ourselves. We can be kind and loving and supportive to the people around us. We can bask in the love that shines our way as a result. And we can get on a court, even in our 60s and 70s and 80s, even with a partially sawed-off finger, and we can compete.
Laura Erin Shield is a writer based in Columbus, Ohio. A longer version of her essay appeared in the September issue of Southwest, the magazine. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR. Only a Game is produced in Boston with help from listeners like you. Why not make a donation today? Just go to donate.npr.org/game to donate to your local station. And thanks. I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, 112 years ago, Auguste Pons set out to drive from what was then Peking to Paris, but he ran out of gas in the Gobi Desert. This year, a Belgian architect tried to finish what Pons started. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
That's a tough place to run out of gas,
it's
Karen.
It's really not good, especially in 1907.
That the auto club is not going to come to you in the middle of the Gobi Desert. It's just not going to happen.
2019 is almost over, and I can think of at least one guy who might not want this year to end. Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson is outperforming Patrick Mahomes' record-setting 2018 fantasy season. His merchandise was Cyber Monday's number one seller, and he's on pace to demolish Michael Vick's single-season rushing record for quarterbacks. Not bad for his first full season as a starter.
No, and the Vick comparisons fall by the wayside because Lamar Jackson can really throw the ball, too.
Right.
And he's a lot of fun. He has made the Baltimore Ravens appointment viewing if you're an NFL fan. I mean, you just don't want to not watch this team.
Meanwhile, the 49ers have suspended radio analyst Tim Ryan for saying the following about Jackson's skill at running fake handoffs.
He's really good at that fake, yep. Lamar Jackson. But when you consider that when he's his dark skin color with a dark football, with a dark uniform, you could not see that thing.
Ryan has apologized, saying, "I regret my choice of words." Is there any word choice that would be less regrettable here?
No, Tim, regret your choice of idea.
Right.
I mean, we have had generations of football analysts, and we've had African Americans in the NFL for generations as well. Nobody came up with this one before.
On Tuesday, Rutgers rehired former head football coach Greg Schiano. Schiano is making what is being called a not exorbitant $4 million a year, plus a paid country club membership, access to private jets for recruiting only. For all other university business, Schiano will be forced to fly first class, and a bunch of other perks. I know that the Rutgers program is a mess, but this seems like a lot for a guy who previously only went 68-67 with the Scarlet Knights.
Hey, he was over 500, which is all Rutgers can expect.
One game.
And by the way, since he left Rutgers, I think Greg Schiano has coached every other football team in the world. Yeah. Or at the very least, he's been rumored to be taking the job. Now he's back home, and Rutgers, of course, is now in what used to be the Big Ten. And I suspect that his, you know, career record at Rutgers, which is one game over 500, is not going to stay there.
Well, it was only 2 years ago that Tennessee fans staged an out-and-out revolt over that school's plans to hire Schiano. Rutgers fans must feel differently, it seems.
Yeah, that was a very strange episode, and I'd forgotten about it. People running for governor in Tennessee had to take positions on whether or not to hire Greg Schiano. That's not happening in New Jersey. Not enough people care about who coaches the Rutgers football team.
Did you see LeBron James's travel on Wednesday?
Oh,
because everyone else saw it except the refs.
I do not know how that was possible. And after the game, LeBron doesn't know, apparently doesn't know how that was. It was just, I mean, first of all, I know how he did it because it was just a complete vapor lock. You're walking the ball up, and you're not really being guarded that hard, and you just, you know, your brain goes away for a few minutes. But how three referees could possibly miss arguably the greatest player in the history of the NBA carrying the ball is beyond me. And actually, I give LeBron a lot of credit. He took the heat and said he was sorry to the referees for the endless ridicule the referees are going to have to suffer for the rest of their lives because this video will never die.
Everybody's known for quite a long time that the vote that brought the 2022 World Cup to Qatar was less than legit.
No!
Now FIFA has finally admitted it, sort of. What's going on?
On the FIFA website, which, despite what you may think, does not have a skull and crossbones on it, there's a document on the website where apparently someone admits that three of the officials got money to vote for Qatar. Putting the thing in Qatar never made any sense.
Right.
There's no way this wasn't a bribery scandal. We all knew that at the time. But now apparently FIFA's got on their websites a clear admission that it was.
Meanwhile, they're saying don't read too much into this. How can we possibly not read into this?
Well, because we already know. I mean, right? Don't take our, FIFA's saying don't take our word for it. Rely on the endless stack of documents that are at the FBI and the Department of Justice.
And finally, Charlie, Flutie Flakes are back. 20 years after the breakfast cereal sold out of grocery stores, Doug Flutie is re-releasing it once again to raise money for his autism foundation. Do you have your bowl and spoon at the ready?
I have never tasted Flutie Flakes.
Neither.
Do you know anyone who, except for the immediate family who's ever eaten Flutie Flakes?
Someone's
don't know
got to send us
if
a box.
If they're like Frosted Flakes or Corn Flakes or Special K.
We know they're flaky.
Yeah, we know they're flaky, and they're probably a bit smaller than the usual flake.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
There are a lot of seemingly unbreakable records in sports. Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game, Nolan Ryan's 7 no-hitters, Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hit streak. But there's another record you might be less familiar with, and it would be pretty hard to break, too. Only a Game's Jonathan Chang has the story.
Detroit has one timeout left. Here we go!
On July 22, 2008, in the closing seconds of a game between the Detroit Shock and the LA Sparks, a brawl broke out. Nancy Lieberman was at a restaurant with her son TJ for his 14th birthday. They watched a melee on TV.
And I'm looking at this going, oh my gosh, this is crazy. I mean, it was a full-on fight.
Lieberman was a 50-year-old analyst for ESPN. But watching the brawl, she didn't see the situation through the lens of a sportscaster. Instead,
I looked at that and I went, oh my gosh, I'm playing.
It all started a year earlier at the 2007 WNBA All-Star Game.
I was doing the TV for ESPN and, they have the skills challenge.
The producers wanted Lieberman to test out the skills challenge, an event designed to showcase a player's dribbling and passing ability so Lieberman could better describe it for the TV audience.
So I took my shoes off, but I was, dressed up more for TV than for, I didn't have any athletic gear on. So they're like, ready, go. And as I finished, I didn't realize that Bill Laimbeer was sitting like off in the bleachers somewhere.
Laimbeer was the head coach of the Shock.
And he came up to me, he goes, that's unbelievable, your time. And I said, really? He goes, you still play? And I said, yeah, I mess around and play a little. He says, when do you turn 50? I said, next July 1st. He says, let's make history. And I was like, what? He goes, play at 50 for me. I was like, absolutely. So I knew I was going to play in 2008. I didn't know when.
After that conversation, Lieberman began training. Running hills, lifting, playing pickup games.
I wanted to see what my limits were, what my capabilities were, and, to walk out there and go, well, who's the 25-year-old and who's the 50-year-old? If you lined our bodies up and you didn't see our heads, you wouldn't know. That was my goal.
So when that brawl broke out between Detroit and L.A., Lieberman was ready to go. The league suspended five players from each team and one of Detroit's assistant coaches.
And Bill called me late that night, and he goes, "Nah, I got a couple roster spots available." he said, "I think this is as good a time as any." And so he says, "Can you come to Houston tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes, sir."
Nancy Lieberman is no stranger to setting records. In 1976, when she was 18, she became the youngest basketball player to medal at the Olympics. In college, she led Old Dominion University to an NIT title and two national championships. In an era when few talked about women's basketball, Lieberman was a national star. Lieberman was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1996, but it wasn't until the following year that the WNBA began.
So I played at 39. I guess I was the oldest player in the league at that point.
Lieberman says she wanted to play until she was 40, but after that season, she received an offer to become the head coach and general manager of the newly founded Detroit Shock.
And I was so excited. 6 months later, I was, my family moved to Detroit.
After three seasons, Lieberman left the Shock and became an analyst at ESPN. On July 24th, 2008, 50-year-old Nancy Lieberman was scheduled to be in Houston for ESPN.
After Bill called me, I called my boss at ESPN and said, "I'm not going to be able to do the game." And Pat goes, "Why?" I said, "I'm going to be playing." And she goes, "What?" I go, "It's a long story, but I'm signing a contract in the morning with the Detroit Shock." I didn't really have much time to be by myself, except I did go back to my room before we went to the arena. And I sat there. I can remember sitting on the bed, just kind of think about what it meant to me. I've given my life to this game. And here it was on yet another level.
When game time rolled around, Lieberman didn't get to start, and that was okay.
The funny part is I'm sitting on the bench, and my son is sitting like across courtside, and he's like looking at his watch and tapping his watch like, "Come on, when are we going to get this thing going?" I'm like, "Dude, man, coach is going to put me in when he wants me to go in."
And it didn't take long before that happened.
And with a minute one to go in the first quarter, we have some people in the arena standing up because Nancy Lieberman, the Hall of Famer, is now in the basketball game.
When I went into the game and I did tell my teammates, I said, "Even if I'm on the court and I don't look at you, just keep your hands up." And they were like, "What?" I said, "Please."
In her day, Lieberman had been known for her no-look passes.
And then when I threw the pass,
it was over the shoulder in traffic.
To my teammate, and she scored, and she was like, oh my gosh, I almost didn't see it. I was like, "I'm just so happy you made it." And it was all over SportsCenter.
The Detroit Shock lost 61-79 to the Houston Comets, and Lieberman posted just 2 assists in 9 minutes. But she had impressed even her opponents by breaking her own record as the oldest player to ever play in a WNBA game.
I remember Tina Thompson hugging me and lifting me off the floor and telling me how proud she was of me. And that's all you could do as an athlete is hope that you've done it the right way and you've been a good influencer. I had hundreds of thousands of letters from people all over the world, Nobody was negative. Probably TJ, because he wanted me to play more minutes. But it was really great. And, even with Bill, it was, there's no need to play another game. And I was like, it can't get better than this. Why would I do anything other than what I just did? And I was like, that's it. I'm retired.
A few days later, Lieberman was back at her old job at ESPN. Is this the most unbreakable record of them all?
Every record is breakable. It's just how far it's pushed. If somebody does it, I would certainly applaud them. I'm not here to hoard anything. We're kind of pushing each other to greatness.
That story came from Only a Game's Jonathan Chang. Nancy Lieberman is now the head coach of Team Power of the Big Three Basketball League.
Mm-hmm.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.